This is sort of moving away from excision, but I mean still within excision, but asking asking a question, maybe a very simple or obvious question to many of us, but someone has to ask it anyway. So the question is that our interest is to actually do binary black hole evolutions using excisions. We face sort of a number of issues here. And first of all, let's take a situation where we truly have an in spiral problem, and we take a snapshot. So we have two excised regions with, I'm assuming excision, with apparent horizons around them, and we can locate, we can find the apparent horizons. We have the technology and ability to do that on the surfaces of constant outgoing or ingoing expansions, given the metric and extrinsic curvature one time slice. So we can do this everywhere in the computational domain. The question is, to evolve to the next time slice, what sort of laps and shifts should we be using, given that we want to do excision techniques? Now, there are a whole host of existing sort of coordinate conditions that are out there that were listed yesterday. And one of the issues that we've actually already come across is what are the appropriate boundary conditions to place at the excision boundaries? And the example that actually, which Berndt mentioned, was an example given by Doug Early using the apparent horizon, sort of using ingoing and outgoing convergences to set boundary conditions for something like maximal slicing or minimal distortion. And we would need things like that. And then the next question is, what properties should we be looking for? What physical, geometrical properties should we be looking for a situation where we have colliding or coalescing black hole space-time? And can one use information given, say, if you have a series of snapshots to the past, can you use information, say, from the apparent horizons or the associated geometry? And sort of the next part of the question is, how can one extract useful physical parameters, spin momentum, et cetera, from the apparent horizons to sort of construct parametrically what sort of a lapse and shift or even the boundary conditions? Because the simulation that we're doing at Texas and Penn State and Pittsburgh is that we're sort of empirically taking our evolution, we have a little joystick, as Roberta puts it, where we follow the black holes for a little while, find the locations. From the locations, we can figure out an estimate of velocity where we should be excising, and we sort of do this game. Now the question is, in general, I mean, how can we extract more physical information? One of the possibilities is work by Ashtekar and Chris Beadle is isolated horizons, perhaps extracting the parameters. But more so than that, is there a framework, and what should we be thinking about here? This is something that's sort of unanswered question in general. We have sort of a list of things, but what should we be looking for is sort of the question I wanted to sort of put forward on the table, sort of a practical question.
Those are the conditions for
on basically a sort of a generic sort of boundary conditions for the lapse and shift. I think it's been a while since I read that paper, but maybe I should turn the microphone off. But essentially, what he had done is look at the ingoing and outgoing convergences, and I think looked at the Einstein equations projected on that. And from that, he got evolution equations for the convergences and got boundary conditions for that. I don't think anyone actually followed, I mean, tried that particular technique out.
But
yeah, but one can, I mean,
because I think Bill probably had a right. We don't know the surface in the space.
I think in space as well. I mean, sure.
But the reality is we do excise a trap surface. We don't quite find the trap surface. What we do is we take the apparent horizon and sort of move in terms of grid points radially inwards is what we're actually doing. You know.
In some way, it's sort of blowing up a balloon. I mean, you get a small enough region where you know that all the outward going normals are pointing in.
Mm.
So you know it's definitely inside, and then you sort of want to blow up that balloon to make that as big a sphere as you can, if you will.
Mm.
And if there's some sort of efficient way of blowing up that balloon, which sort of moving, keeping it inside the apparent horizon at all. I mean, always keeping its divergence negative, its outward divergence negative, but...
So what's wrong with just having the surface and just making sure that it's outward?
Right, but you don't want it too small, because if it's too small, then you're going to get run into the trouble that if you follow it, you're going to run into the singularity type of thing.
But you're going to take every snapshot. You're not going to quite follow that surface as it evolves, but you're going to each time you're going to sort of find a new surface of that sort. So
I think this is one of the things I'm trying to get at. I mean, what could we do just pragmatically? What could we be monitoring, measuring in order that we could pick out a good surface and in order to diagnostic to tell us if that surface is good? And how can we tell where the black holes really are? And remember, it's made up of the curvature of the surface, so you sort of push it in here where things you would think are diverging faster, but straighten out the surface somewhat to make the null cone diverge less.
The worry about not using apparent horizon is really in the distant future where everything is settled down. Then it's too close to the event horizon. Right?
Operationally, it's probably a really bad idea.
Numerical inaccuracy can throw you outside, and then you're suddenly in trouble.
And also, the vertical is very expensive to locate on each time set.
Yeah, but really, you don't need that. You just need something which has negative curve, some closed surface which has negative curvature.
So we do not track precisely the generalization at each time, every time set.
But the point about.
When we use IMJ,
tend to be very inaccurate in this very strong field region, and they're changing rapidly from point to point. Even just to construct an inner surface is difficult.
Yeah, but I think at the end of the day, when we get this all going, we're going to know that most of a lot of our resolution is going to be down there anyway. We're going to need a lot of resolution in strong field regions, right? So right now it's a few grid points. I'm hoping in 10 years we'll have hundreds of grid points in across the black hole, and then.
But we might not want to tie the computational domain very closely on such a surface that requires high accuracy.
But the question of you said a lot of computational time needed for apparent horizons, but if you look at a limit where a three-dimensional grid gets larger and larger, in that limit you're talking about n squared problem versus n cubed problem. It's not that much more expensive. At least the finite difference methods in comparison to our number of time steps are not that much more expensive actually.
And also
you don't need to find it every slice. So I'm not sure that's a problem per se, you know. Yeah, it's an n squared problem. So I guess that was primarily the question. I mean, after Bernd went through the overview, that was one of the questions I wanted to put up for discussion. Sorry, Kent.
I want to show you one we should also worry about the stability of that condition. That turns out to be, I think, important in the local grouping. What do I mean? For example, network sizes, k equals 0. We know that is in very many situations is a very nice property. But if you can manage just naively, like k dot equals 0, right? And then you k equals 0, and not k dot equals 0, such a condition, k dot equals 0, is in fact not very stable. In the sense that it allows k to drift away from 0 when you are forward. It would be much better to enforce this k equals 0 condition, not simply by writing down a gauge condition of k dot equals 0, but using k dot equals minus k. In this coordinate condition, that we can more stably enforce the coordinate condition. The stability of coordinate condition is something that we should be cognizant of.
And one thing that still worries me a little bit about those gyro conditions, though, is they kind of screw up the convergence of you. You're not really solving a system of differential equations anymore, but every once in a while you're approximately solving a differential equation. And you definitely have the case where your convergence criteria depends on the mesh station, then you're not going to be constructing something that has the regular kind of convergence.
Sorry, can we just postpone this? Because I think we have 50 minutes in our ordinary schedule. I think it's really worth talking about causal connection in the context of
this. This is the last thing we have to discuss.
So this started when I asked a question the other day about had people tried causal reconnection, and somebody said, what is causal reconnection? So I'm glad to have the chance to talk about it, the pointer. It's something that has been around a long time, hasn't ever been tried in general relativity, I think. I want to talk about it because I think it does have a couple of things to recommend it, but particularly now as we get into the issues around excision where causality is really important, and we have superluminal coordinates and things like that if we manage to keep them out of the black hole, keep them from falling into the black hole. So this is a reference for it. Miguel and I wrote this paper actually a couple of years before it was published. This was at a time when JCompFiz was taking over a year to publish papers, and they went through a bad patch there. We got stuck in it. We worked on it about the same time that Ed and Wimo worked on causal differencing. They worked on it. They did their causal differencing in the context of a black hole. We did ours in the context of sort of general discussions about differencing for wave equations. So we have tests of this only on the scalar wave equation. I said it hasn't been done in other ways, but maybe it's time to think about these things. It's all about causality. So let's look at causality. Here's a forget about the stuff that's at the bottom of this. Here's a typical situation differencing. So here's a grid. The blue stuff, the blue dots are a grid, just written down in the order in which the indices run along the grid. So the blue dots don't indicate anything about the structure of space-time or the light cones. And so the vertical direction is your time direction, but going along a constant spatial position. The horizontal direction is the spatial. Going along a constant spatial direction may not be time-like. But in the standard case, in the simple case where everything is well behaved, you set up differencing with a stencil, let's say a second order differencing on a stencil like that, and then there's an issue everybody is aware of, which is what do the light cones look like? These are the physical light cones that I'm drawing, and if your physical light cones are narrow enough so that if I start at the top of the stencil and I go down, I'm not wider than the spacing between the next grid points, if I'm in that condition, then I have a stable differencing scheme. And if the physical light cone is indicated by the dashed line, then typically I get unstable differencing. That's the CFL, Curran-Friedrich lax condition. And the reason for that is clear, that physically there's information that ought to be given inside this light cone, which isn't being captured because the light cone is going outside the domain on which you're differencing. I mean, that's a sort of hand-waving description of why we seem to get those instabilities. But it's clearly related to causality. The interesting thing happens if you have a true light cone that isn't nice in relation to the grid. And this is what you can get near the horizon. For instance, this could be the horizon. This would then, if this were the horizon, this would then represent a grid that's actually moving slightly outward in the, from the horizon, as you might have for the grid points that are coming out the back of the hole as it's moving. We would ideally like to have a grid like that with shift conditions that keep the grid points from falling into the horizon. So this is the typical sort of situation we think we might encounter. If that's the true light cone, then it's clear you're going to have some problems differencing on that. Let me adjust the stencil, adjust the light cone to be over there. Let's see if I. And first of all, I'm reusing these acetate sheets, so let's only look at this part here. Forget that. I'll move that over here soon. But this is the way you naively might want to put a stencil, a second-order stencil. And clearly, you are differencing here with points that are outside the light cone. You're not getting the information that you should have from inside the light cone. And sure enough, your differencing scheme turns out to be unstable. You get all sorts of bad behavior. You don't want to be doing that. Now, causal differencing recognizes that and tries to and adopts a scheme of interpolation to bring the to widen the stencil and bring the information from inside light cone to the appropriate points in the stencil. Causal reconnection, which is what I want to talk about, is conceptually quite a simple idea. It's just you use a different stencil. So if I can line these things up properly. Sorry, everything's getting rotated here. You can do it in lots of conditions, but you have to draw it for one. All right, stop. Okay. With causal reconnection, the statement is simply, let's use the same physical stencil, the one that's inside the Lycon. Let's use this point, that point, and that point, and the two neighboring points to that one to construct a second order stencil. These are the ones that are actually physically close to one another, even though they might be separated in grid. In fact, if the Lycon tilts over quite far, you might have to go way over here to find the related points. You might have that one related to that one, depending upon what's happened to your grid. But these are actually the physically related ones, and so this is where the differencing ought to go. So causal reconnection is simply you reconnect the grid. Instead of having a stencil that connects up points in time and space like that, you look at the causal relations, you look at the local light cones, and you connect up points to form stencils like that.
So you recompute the stencil every time?
You recompute the stencil every time, sir. Well, there's no interpolation involved in this. This is, you simply do this differencing on that stencil. That's right. That's right. So with, I'll come back to, there is a situation, I might as well say it here. There is a situation where causal reconnection can't be done. And that's a situation where the light cone, let's say the time step is so small. Imagine bringing the time step down to half. Oh, gosh, I really messed it up. Imagine bringing the time step down to half of what I've shown. So that I'm starting with the top point there, which I haven't drawn in. Then you see I've missed all the points on this grid here. These two points are both outside Lycon. I don't have a differencing point here. The time step is too short. I can't do causal reconnection. It's not guaranteed to that I have a point inside the light cone that I can simply reconnect to. And in which case you'd have to interpolate. And as Wimo says, the interpolation is designed to give you the best stencil, let's say, to interpolate out to the values here. But our experience with the scalar wave equation was that it's perfectly accurate. It's convergent, second order convergent. So if you just do the connections. Now, you do have to recompute the stencil, but that's very cheap. That's just an order n, where n is the total number of points in the grid operation. You do it once every time step. It's very cheap compared to the interpolations that are used in causal differencing. So that's one of the advantages that I see to recommend itself at a time when we're trying lots of different techniques and we may want to build a system that runs cheaply. It's certainly very cheap. There's almost no overhead in doing the reconnection. But the second thing is something we haven't talked about before, and which I think needs investigation, but I think it might be an advantage, which is that you're decoupling, entirely decoupling the coordinate system from issues of causality. You can adopt any kind of shift condition. You're not interpolating in a coordinate system or anything like that. You're just looking at the causal relation between your grid points, and so you're really decoupling these two issues of the causal propagation of information and the structure of your coordinate system. And it may be very useful to be able to decouple those in trying to find suitable coordinate conditions. There are questions that are not clear to me. One is stability. In our simulations of the wave equation, it was very stable. We had no problems, but we haven't tested in general relativity. Another question I think I could answer in the affirmative, does this allow rotating grids? The clear problem with a rotating grid is you're going to have, if you have any kind of size, you're going to have superluminal shift at the surface. at the edge. Well, that's quite expensive if you have an interpolated scheme like causal differencing. But if you just have a reconnection scheme, and we did this in Miguel's thesis, there's examples of very rapidly rotating grids solving the scalar wave equation, waves propagating off the grid, no problem at all. So I think, you know, if you're thinking maybe the right thing to do for some of these problems is to go to a rotating coordinate system, then this kind of reconnection scheme may be appropriate.
I don't quite understand why the light source indicates the grid point by the drawback, because you know, you just take a center grid point to 1 meter to the light source and do
So that may not be a problem then. I don't know. Yes. Yeah. I agree. That's an unresolved question. But if it's not a problem, then that's not.
Well,
then
that doesn't. That shouldn't be necessarily that small.
Well, that depends on the left side. But for example, if you attack inside the horizon in the buffer zone, very often the left becomes small, very small than the when time doesn't cover more.
Can you try this for two of the schemes?
Yeah, that's right. So we
have any idea whether you expect it will work?
I haven't tried it, but I expect it to work in the natural because it's only a funding factor.
It was standard scheme. It wasn't leapfrog because it was just a simple scalar wave equation. So anyway, I recommend this to people who are actually working on the problem because it's potentially a lot cheaper, but you know it needs to be tested and maybe it'll turn out not to be very good. But also, it might enable the rotating coordinate systems, and that might be particularly helpful. Okay.